Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everybody, welcome to part two of Mongol Week. We're getting beyond the life of Genghis Khan and troop formations into other aspects. Everyday life, religious tolerance, the global age of trade, and all other things that I could think of. Before delving into these things, though, I have an announcement about the podcast. This episode is the first episode of a new format that we're doing for the show. Up until now, since May 2017, when we launched the show, there was a long-form episode on Monday where I go solo or talk with an author, and then Tuesday through Friday, I would take audience questions. I'm still following that format, but it's going to be divvied up differently in the episodes. Now, instead of four episodes, there's going to be one episode that's longer, but it's going to be broken up into different sections. Now, sometimes it'll be like an anthology where I might have three or four different topics that I cover based on listener questions. I could talk about the history of the Secret Service, quack doctors of the 19th century, methods of conquering a medieval castle, or the reception of the New Deal all in one episode. So it's kind of like four episodes crammed into one episode in a sense. And it's also 40 minutes, 50 minutes long. But more often than not, what I would like to do is tackle one topic because a lot of times listeners might have similar questions. They might ask about something with World War II. Maybe one person asks about close air support. Another person asks about amphibious assault. Another person asks about how much did Germans know about the Holocaust? So I could group these all together into one episode, but there might be three or four distinct chapters. And I think I'll move more into that format. So I know you as listeners, a lot of you have commented that you like how the show is mixed up. Sometimes there's longer episodes. And then when you're going on a commute to work, you also like having shorter episodes. So if you have 10 or 20 minutes to listen, then you can do that. And you will still have that possibility with the show. I'll try to make it pretty clear when I'm going from one section to the next section. So you have those bite-sized chunks, but then you also have the ease where your RSS feed isn't being flooded with tons and tons of new episodes. Anyway, let me know what you think about this new structure. I'm always up to your comments and your suggestions. And I should also mention, too, that we are launching a History Unplugged Facebook group. That's where I'll be posting all of the episodes. You can find me on Facebook really easily. And that's where the discussion will take place. Is there anything you heard in the episode that you disagreed with, or maybe you have more thoughts on? And that's a way that we can keep the conversation going, because I don't want this just to be a monologue on my end. Okay, it kind of is on a podcast, but I love listener feedback. There's always something that I can miss or overlook or be ignorant of. I mean, history is infinite, and I love getting other people's feedback on things. So in today's episode, this is how we're going to do it. We'll have about four different sections. First, I'm going to talk about the Mongolian use of psychological warfare as they fought. Then I'll talk about everyday life. What's it like when you wake up on the Mongolian steppe in your yurt, you eat some soup made from field onions, and then you drink some horse milk, then you tear down your yurt and get ready to follow your flock. Then in the third part, I'll talk about how the Mongolians kicked off the great age of global trade. They supercharged the Silk Road. They provided enough security for it that it was possible for someone like Marco Polo to go from Venice all the way to Samarkand and China and everywhere else in between. And then the last part is a look at Mongolians and religious tolerance. Some people argue that the very constitutional idea of the separation of church and state comes from the Mongols, and Thomas Jefferson was directly influenced by the Mongols. Now, what tolerance meant to a Mongolian in 1100 is very different from what an Enlightenment intellectual like Jefferson would consider in 1700. So I want to look at why some historians would think that there's a line of continuity between the two, but also how these understandings of tolerance differ and if tolerance is even the right word to use. So those are the four sections. Now we're going to look at what I think everyone really cares about, and that's Mongolian military tactics and the Mongolian use of psychological warfare. And to zero in, I want to focus on the campaign against the Khwarezmian Empire and the conquest of Bukhara. This is one of the most famous military campaigns of Genghis Khan. And it comes after he subjugated large portions of Central Asia, China, and Western Iran. This is where Genghis reaches his pinnacle of power and wealth. And his conquest of the Khwarezmian capital of Bukhara came in 1220, and it's located in modern-day Uzbekistan, through a shocking surprise attack. To give an overview, one part of his army took the direct route from Mongolia to attack the Khwarezmian borders. This was the line of attack which the enemy sultan expected, following the well-worn paths of the Silk Road. But Genghis secretly led another division of warriors over a distance of 2,000 miles, longer than almost any army had ever covered, and especially faster than anyone had ever covered, crossing mountains, desert, and steppe to strike deep within enemy territory. His target of Bukhara was a major trade hub of the Silk Road, the economic backbone of the medieval world. It stood at the center of a fertile oasis along one of the many tributaries of the Amu Darya River. The city teemed with libraries and scholars, which Muslims described as Noble Bukhara, the center of religious piety considered the ornament and delight to all Islam. But Genghis was not risking his life in the desert to conquer this city for propagandistic or material purposes. He fought for revenge. The Khwarezmian Sultan had looted a Mongol trade caravan and disfigured the faces of Mongolian ambassadors set to negotiate a trade pact. With this insult burning in his mind, Genghis Khan bore down on the city on his horse, ready to raze it to the ground like no other city he had conquered. He and his shock troops crossed the Kızılkum, the fabled Red Desert. It was a desiccated wasteland so devoid of water that even trade caravans avoided it, traveling hundreds of extra miles to detour. This was precisely why he chose to attack from that direction. He befriended nomads in the area and led his army through the stone and sand desert. Any other army would have died in the desert, but the Mongols were different. They traveled lightly, with no supply train behind them. An infantry could only go maximum 20 miles a day, and there's no way they could have made it through a desert like this without dying of thirst. But for the Mongols, each soldier had three or four horses in their possession for remounts. The horse was their long-distance transportation, their battle carriage, their source of milk, and, when necessary, their source of liquid in the form of blood. They could just nick a vein and have a few drops of it if a soldier were thirsty enough. An injured horse became a source of hundreds of pounds of fresh meat for hungry soldiers. All they required was water and grassland for grazing. They could even go without these two necessities for a limited time, as they were forced to do in the Red Desert. Unlike other conventional armies of the day, they did not have to wait for baggage trains or slow-moving siege engines. The cavalry could move up to 100 miles a day, by far the swiftest military in history until the invention of trains in the 19th century. The army crossed the Red Desert in the coldest months so that the men and horses required less water. Dew formed on the ground, stimulating the growth of small patches of grass. Game presented itself before it was shot out of the sky. Nearly all weaponry they would use for battle was transported on horseback. If any siege engines were necessary, they would be built on the spot from available materials. The Great Khan's steely determination and calculating mind was on full display in the Mongolian army's invasion of Bukhara. In Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, Jack Weatherford described the attack as a masterful display of psychological warfare. When the advance guard emerged from the desert and spotted the first small settlement, the detachment slowed down into a lumbering pace. Genghis Khan did not race to Bukhara immediately after entering Khwarezmian domains. Since no reinforcements could leave the border cities under attack by his army, he had time to manipulate public fear and hope. His plan was to frighten the enemy into surrendering before battle actually began. By first conquering several small towns, his army sent locals fleeing to Bukhara as frightened refugees, telling of the apocalyptic destruction of the Mongolian horsemen, monsters animated by some sort of dark magic that did not need water to live, for they crossed the desert, something that everyone knew was impossible. The refugees filled Bukhara and spread these tales, increasing fear in the city. The Persian chronicler, Atamalike Juvani, described his approach when the people saw the countryside all around them choked with horsemen and the air black as night with the dust of cavalry. Fright and panic overcame them, and fear and dread prevailed. He issued customary terms of surrender to the outlying communities, many of whom accepted the terms and joined the Mongols, receiving leniency from their would-be slaughterers. The Persian chronicler noted, "Whoever yields and submits to them is safe and free from the terror and disgrace of the severity. Those that refused became part of the Mongolian attack plan. They were herded before the armies to be used as cannon fodder in the first wave of attacks on the Khwarezmian city. Bukharan soldiers guarded the city's outer walls, fearing the Mongols so greatly that they abandoned the city's citadel. The warriors cut them down without wasting motion or energy. The Great Khan entered the city. Fear and awe spread among the inhabitants. His presence was that of a deity. Persian chronicler Minaj al-Siraj Jujani described him as a man of tall stature, of vigorous build, robust in body, the hair on his face scanty and turned white, with cat's eyes, possessed of dedicated energy, discernment, genius, and understanding, awe-striking, a butcher, just resolute, an overthrower of enemies. With his inhuman ability to conquer and survive in inhospitable conditions, the chronicler says he was adept at magic and deception, and some of the devils were his friends. As Genghis and his troops began the systematic plundering of the city, locals remained baffled by the steppe barbarian. Horse nomads had threatened Bukhara for centuries, but none of them could overcome the city's massive walls. Steppe armies lacked the food, water, and siege equipment to pose a serious threat. All the urban armies, staffed by their professionally trained soldiers, had to do was hold out behind the massive stone walls of their citadel. No tribal army they had ever seen mastered the art of siege warfare. The Mongol army, furthermore, used weapons of their own making, and their bows were non-standard and varied in quality, looking amateurish next to the well-clad soldiers of Bukhara. But none of that mattered. The army of the steppe warriors attacked enemy infantry on the ground, but paired with these cavalry forces were the highest forms of Chinese military sophistication, early forms of armaments that later became mortars and cannons, machines of destruction that could raise any city wall. Fire and death rained down on Mongolian enemies. And as I mentioned in earlier episodes, the Mongols were able to master siege warfare through the help of Chinese siege engineers. So that's a small taste of the brutal tactics Genghis employed, but also utilizing the unfair advantages of his horse nomadic army and what they could accomplish that other armies could not. All right, so that's our overview of psychological warfare of the Mongols. Let's shift gears and stop just considering them as soldiers. We are stepping away from the battles, warfare, slaughter of millions, and all the other things that we know the Mongolians for. And we're going to take a look at what their society was like, how it was set up, what was it like for relations with men, women, and children living in a yurt, what kind of clothes did you wear, what kind of food did you eat, and all other things that made your average day for a Mongolian. A Mongolian society was patriarchal, and I'm not using that in the 21st century gender politics sense. I mean that it was patrilineal. The men had informal and also institutional control in their family. But in many ways, Mongolian women had far more freedom and power than women in other cultures, such as Persia and China at the time. When practices like foot binding were occurring, Mongolian women were riding horseback, fighting in battles, tending their herds, and influencing their men on important decisions for their growing empire. Still, while women were highly valued participants in Mongolian society, they still had less rank than their fathers, husbands, and brothers. Work was divided between men and women. The men handled the herds and went to battle. The women raised the yurts, made the clothes, milked the animals, made cheese, and cooked the food. Men and women raised their children together. Children of the Mongols did not attend a school because what would be out there on the steppe? Rather, they learned from their families the roles and work of men and women. Marriages were usually arranged between families, with goods traded between the families as bride prices and dowries. Occasionally, a woman was stolen from one tribe by a man from another. Genghis's father, Yesugai, for example, stole his mother, Hualun, from another tribe. Stealing women was not done often, as it could lead to a blood feud between the tribes. Men could practice polygamy, marrying more than one woman. Each wife and her child had their own yurt. The first wife was consigned the legal wife, although these distinctions didn't matter much except in terms of inheritance. The children of the first wife would inherit more than the children from other wives. Married women wore headdresses to distinguish themselves from unmarried women. These headdresses could be quite elaborate, as all Mongols loved hats and headgear because they showed social distinction. Women typically didn't remarry if her husband died. A widow inherited the property of her dead husband and became head of the family. A good illustration of this, and of the power of women to influence Mongolian history, was Sor Khoktani, wife of Genghis's son Toluai. Sor Khoktani had been an advisor to another of Genghis's sons, Ogedai, when he was Khan. When Toluai died, she became the head of her household of sons, including Monke, Kublai, Hulagu, and Arikboke, who all became Khans in their time. She insisted that they all become educated and learned in the languages they would need to know as leaders of an empire. After Ogedai's death, Sorkhakhtani kept the empire together by diplomatic means while Gyuk was Khan. After his death, her son Mongke became Great Khan. Sorkhakhtani's work for the empire included opening trade, instituting intellectual exchanges throughout the empire, emphasizing freedom of religion, and advising that conquered people should not be dangerously exploited. Okay, so that's a little bit about social structure. Let's talk about where you lived as a Mongolian. You lived in a yurt. This is the perfect dwelling for any pastoral nomad. And accordingly, they've been used for thousands of years on the Eurasian steppe. Yurts are movable. They can be packed up and put on a camel or oxen's back or on a cart. They're lightweight but sturdy. Since they are round, they can withstand the winds that constantly blow on the steppes. The walls are made of latticed, crisscrossed, flexible wood and are about 6 feet tall. The roof is conical with about 80 poles running from the walls to the crown, a circular ring to which all roof poles are attached. The walls and roofs are covered with thick, warm felt or unwoven wool. A wooden door or felt flap provides the entrance to the yurt. It can house from 5 to 15 people depending on its size. Extra wall sections called khanas can be added to enlarge the yurt as the family grows. Inside it, the right side is for men, the left for women, with a fireplace or stove in the center. Smoke can exit through the crown of the roof, or the crown can be closed with a felt flap during bad weather. At night, a family would retire to the yurt to cook and eat the evening meal. Mattresses would be unrolled and placed around the fire for sleeping. While there might be benches and chairs around the walls of the yurt, usually there were no beds. People slept on the mattresses that were rolled up and stored the next day. Mongolian nomads went everywhere with their yurts and their herds, and they moved 3 or 4 times a year. They would move from the southern pastures in the winter to mountain valleys in the summer. Occasionally, they would move to fresh pastures so the herds could eat. Felt walls insulated the yurts so they were relatively warm in the winter and cool in the summer. Yurts can be beautifully decorated on the inside with brightly colored woven mats. Hanging from pegs to walls were all kinds of storage bags made of leather, cooking implements, fur hats and coats, and other items of regular use. On the men's side of the yurt would be the saddles and tack and other tools used by the men. On the women's side would be the kitchen area where they prepared food. Yurts could be taken down or put up in an hour, with another hour spent packing them on backs of camels or oxen. Alternatively, an entire yurt could be put on a cart and drawn by oxen. Genghis Khan's yurt was moved this way, and they traveled with Mongolians everywhere except when men left for war. A warrior band might take a few yurts with them, but most would sleep outside during this time. Another factor is diet. What did you eat as a Mongolian? Mongolians then and now lived in a harsh climate with long, bitterly cold winters and short summers. Living as they did in an inhospitable climate, they ate foods they got from their animals. Farming wasn't possible for the most part, so the most prominent foods in the diet were meat and milk products such as cheese and yogurt. And they got these from their horses, sheep, camels, cattle, and goats. As their herds ate up the grass, they'd pack up their yurts and move to fresher pastures. Thus, their food groups were predominantly milk products and a variety of meats. While the Mongols appreciated milk products, they didn't drink fresh milk. Instead, they fermented milk from mares, making an alcoholic drink known as kumis. After women finished milking the cattle, goats, and sheep, they would process the milk into milk curds, yogurts, and interestingly enough, this is one of the very few words from the Turkic language that exists in English, yogurt. It comes from the word yort, which they coined. The Mongols had two main food groups, the white foods and the red. The white were the milk products, and the red foods were meat, and the Mongols ate meat from all their animals. Meat was either skewered and roasted over a fire, or boiled into stews and soups. Whatever vegetables the Mongols gathered on their journeys also went into soups and stews. Usually they could find wild onion and garlic, but tubers, roots, seeds, and berries went into the stew pot. So they had basic diets, and when you did come across meat, then Mongolians would feast. I mentioned in an earlier episode of this podcast who had the worst flatulence in history. That was during a Q&A episode, and to prove that I will answer absolutely any question that I have for my audience, one of my answers were the sons of Genghis Khan. That's because they came into unimaginable wealth, and many of his sons and grandsons suffered from obesity and gout and died from alcoholism. Because when you live in a grow up in a society of scarcity where you're having cheeses, milk, occasional meats, and suddenly you're wealthy beyond belief and can eat anything you want, many of these Khans ate almost nothing but meat and no vegetables and drank excessively, so their health was incredibly poor. It's like having a half-starving horse and suddenly you give him a bottomless feed bag. Now, here's just a few other points on Mongolian diet. As nomads, they didn't have ovens, so they couldn't make bread. Since they didn't farm, they also didn't have many vegetables. What they had was what they could find on the steppes, like wild onions and garlic. But after their empire grew, the Mongols gained access to some Chinese food such as rice and flour, and they could use these to make noodles and bread. When the Mongols were on the move, a warrior's wife might hand him a bag of meat, onions, and flour, or rice. The warrior would stick the bag under his saddle, and the heat from the friction of his body and the horse would cook the ingredients in the bag into a kind of stew. Mongol warriors would also nick a vein on their pony's neck and drink a few gulps of the horse's blood. If you were riding a mare, the warrior might also grab a few mouthfuls of milk from the mare's teat during a brief stop. One last thing I want to mention are clothing that Mongols would wear. Now, clothing is actually pretty important because we don't have many written sources from nomadic culture. They didn't write the way that settled populations around them did because when you're nomadic, you don't have the institutional infrastructure for schools, you can't get paper, you can't get parchment. One historian I talked to likened Mongolian clothing as the texts that we have from them to understand their own culture. And that's why nomads typically get a bad rap in history, because they're written about by people that went to war with them. So if the only accounts you have about yourself are from your enemies, it's never going to be very good or very flattering. One way that social distinctions would be shown, and I'm just going to mention Mongolian hats. Mongols loved their headgear and had over 100 different types of hats. Each tribe had a distinctive type of headgear. One common hat was the lovuz, made of felted wool, which served for daily wear. It had flaps that could be tied up or lowered to cover the ears. Wintertime brought warm hats made of fur, such as sable or silver fox. During festivals, Mongol men and women wore their fanciest hats and headgear, colorful and gaudy, with decorations, including fancy fabrics and jewels. And here's one example of headgear that has influence in Europe that we would never expect. When we think of women's hats in the Middle Ages, we imagine the long, pointy traffic cone. And the origin of the iconic princess headgear owes its origin to a Mongolian warrior queen hat that Marco Polo brought back from his travels. The European princess hat is modeled directly after the bokta of Mongolian queens, which could reach 7 feet in height. And of course, these are ceremonial because they're very impractical in regular life. And this is also decades after Genghis Khan, when the Mongolian Empire is at the height of its wealth and prestige. So you wouldn't see these on Mongolian nomadic shepherd wives 200 years earlier. Polo brought at least one of these hats back from his journey to Central Asia. Soon afterwards, there was a boom in popularity of this cone-shaped piece of headgear, which became the rage among female European royalty. The bokta was a direct inspiration for the European hennin, the cone hat that came to signify royalty among all pale-skinned ladies of medieval portraiture. They modified the hat slightly by placing gauzy streamers at its top instead of peacock feathers and placed it toward the back of their heads rather than setting it to rise straight up as the Mongols did. But everything else about the hat was borrowed directly from the court of Genghis Khan's descendants. So that is everyday life in the Mongolian Empire. We zeroed in and we zoomed in to the microscopic details of daily life. Now let's telescope out and look at the vast macro global level of the influence of the Mongolian Empire. We're going to be talking about perhaps the greatest legacy that the Mongolian Empire left on the world, and that is trade. Because of the power of the Mongols, because of the vast territory they controlled, and because they supported trade and safe passage of traders, they perhaps did more than anybody else to unite Europe and China, which really had no historical connection with one another. There are some second-hand or third-hand reports of people in the ancient world reaching China, but there was no lasting connection forged, and that is until the Mongols came along. Let's talk about what they did to connect China with Europe, how their specific policies supported traders and travelers, and who some of these famous travelers were. Marco Polo is only able to do what he does as a direct result of the Mongols, and he is by no means one of the first people to reach China. The only reason he could get as far as he did is because his father and uncle had made the trip long before him, and he came around a good 3 or 4 decades into the period of trade between Europe and China. He just happened to leave behind the most extensive account. That's why we remember him today. Now let's talk about the Mongolians and trade. Even before the rise of Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire, the Mongols favored trade. As a pastoral nomadic people, their lives focused on their herds. For that reason, very few Mongols were weapon makers or potters or weavers. But many of the items the Mongol people needed for living, they had to trade for with settled agricultural peoples around them. Because they could cover such vast distances, this made them excellent intermediaries between China, civilizations in Central Asia, and Iran. That's why, even though they're described in the chronicles of these settled societies as God's scourge on earth, the reality is they were much more interconnected and interdependent with each other than we would assume. The Mongolians needed a trade for basic goods, but these civilizations also needed the Mongols as go-betweens. So they cooperated much more than they engaged in warfare with one another. Just as much as being warriors, the Mongolians were exemplars at trade. As Genghis began building his empire, he realized the Mongol army would need many things: bows, arrows, swords, and spears for war, tack for the horses, leather for armor, and, once it was discovered that silk worn under leather could prevent an arrow from penetrating the body, silk clothing. Genghis Khan also needed people who could read and write to administrate the lands coming under his sway. The Mongols needed trade as never before. To facilitate trade, Genghis offered protection for merchants who began to come from east and west. He also offered a high status for merchants than that allowed by the Chinese or Persians, who looked down upon trade and traders more so. During the Mongol Empire, merchants found protection, status, tax exemption, loans, and consistent aid for the Khans. For the first 100 years of the height of the empire, the east-west trade routes became the fabled Silk Road, which had existed, of course, long before the Mongolians, but was supercharged by them in ways never before, linking Europe to Asia, allowing the free flow of ideas, technologies, and goods. Now, there were always intermediaries on the Silk Road. Almost nobody traveled the whole length. There'd be middlemen who would travel a certain leg, transfer the goods to the next middleman, and they would go onward. Part of this is practicality. If you're going over mountain passes, you would want pack animals, like donkeys. So if you were the person who is known to cover this route, these would be the animals under your ownership. Now, if you're going a relatively flat expanse, then you would have camels and a caravan. It made no sense as one middleman to own all of these different animals. You would simply own what was suitable for a certain leg, and you would go that distance. Then you would hand off your goods to the next person. Now, in times before the Mongols and times after them, when the Silk Road was much more dangerous, there would be many more middlemen. The price of these goods would inflate. You'd probably need more soldiers in order to protect you from the relative lawlessness on the Silk Road. But during the time of the Mongol Empire, less protection was necessary, so the price of goods was cheaper. Now, it was still very expensive, and as I explained in an earlier episode, the price of cinnamon in Europe was worth literally more in its weight than gold, which is part of what kicked off the Age of Discovery, so Europeans could go directly to the source of these goods, but they were only aware of these on a higher level due to the increased exposure by the Mongols. The Mongols not only offered the use of this tax incentive system to merchants, but set up protective associations for them called ortolg. Instead of extortionist tax rates, the Mongols gave traders tax exemption. Genghis offered a form of passports that allowed them to safely travel along the Silk Road. If you are a bandit and you saw someone with one of these passports and realized that attacking this merchant can bring the wrath of the Mongolian army on you, you would definitely think twice. The Mongols even loaned money at low interest to merchants. Paper money was used as currency. It was backed with silk and precious metals. As a result of the Mongol Empire, international trade was born on a level never seen before. Valuable spices, tea, Asian artwork, and silk headed west to waiting merchants in the Middle East and Europe. Gold, medical manuscripts, astronomical tomes, and porcelain headed east to Asia. Ideas and new technologies also flowed in both directions on the Silk Road. Mongols opened their doors to all religions and diplomats from all over the known world. For the first time, the Mongols settled in a major capital city, Karakorum, which was built by Ogedai Khan, Genghis's third son. Mongolian sons attended schools and learned the many languages needed to run the empire: Persian, Chinese, assorted Turkic languages, Uyghur. Although the Mongolian Empire was founded on blood and conquest, its long-term effect, as envisioned by Genghis Khan, was to secure a general peace and establish international trade over a huge part of the world. Let me talk about a few different characters to give an idea what this looks like. When the Mongolian Empire attacked Europe in the 1240s, some historians have described this as a tsunami, where it crashed into Europe, but then it pulled Europe east in its wake. Many Europeans went to the Mongolian Empire, first as captives, forced to work in the mines there, but then through missionaries and papal envoys, then later merchants. The Italian explorer and Archbishop Giovanni de Pian de Carpine and Polish friar and traveler Benedict Polak were the first papal envoys to reach Karakorum when they were sent by Pope Innocent IV in 1245. Catholic missionaries soon established a considerable presence in China due to the religious tolerance of the Mongols. The Franciscan monk William of Rubruck was there from 1253 to 1255 and reported numerous Europeans in Central Asia. He described German prisoners who had been enslaved and forced to mine gold and manufacture iron weapons in a town in modern-day Kyrgyzstan. There were also diplomatic channels set up. In 1248, King Louis IX of France met two envoys from the Persian Khan Goyuk in Cyprus. The topic of discussion was to form an alliance to crush their common enemy, the Muslim Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt, and coordinate military efforts against Muslim targets in the Middle East. So let's come to the most famous merchant in the age of the Mongol Empire, and that's Marco Polo. And I don't have time to talk about other famous travelers and explorers like Rabban Barsamwa, who came from China to Europe in the 1200s, or Ibn Battuta in the early 1300s. Now, interest in the Middle East and Asia had begun to take hold in Europe ever since the Crusades a century earlier. Italian merchants ventured beyond the boundaries of Europe to take advantage of the growing interest in spices, jewels, clothing, and silks. Polo, furthermore, benefited from being born in the right family. His father and uncle were successful jewel merchants in Venice and spent considerable time traveling to and trading with Asian countries. Niccolo and Maffeo Polo first arrived in China in 1261, and there they nurtured a relationship with Kublai Khan, ruler of China and Mongolia. In this period, the great Italian city-states of Venice, Pisa, and Genoa dominated trade in the Mediterranean. Their networks had moved up through the Aegean and into the Black Sea, opening up trade routes with the Tatars of the Crimean Peninsula. But rumors of wealth in Asia prompted brave explorers such as the Polo brothers to venture beyond those domains. Befitting the age in which the Mongolians were interested in a political alliance with Europe, the Khan chose the Italian brothers to travel home to Rome and speak on his behalf. He sent them back to the West with letters for Pope Clement IV, expressing a desire for friendship and requesting they send scholars and missionaries. Some historians have taken the request of the latter to indicate the great Khan's interest in converting his people to Christianity, although he may have preferred the latter for their reputation as being the most highly educated men in the land, rather than because of an expressed interest in their religion. Marco Polo's father, however, thought otherwise and hoped that the Pope would equip him with a troop of priests and religious items to return to China and introduce the Chinese to Roman Catholicism. Marco's father did not get his wish, but he did continue to trade with Kublai Khan and his subjects. He and his brother arrived home in 1269. Marco joined them on their next trip out in 1271. The travelers reached the Khan's dazzling summer palace of Xanadu, located northwest of Beijing across the Great Wall, 3.5 years after leaving Venice. Marco was awestruck by the court's opulence and exotic nature. The wide-eyed 21-year-old described the court as the greatest that ever was seen, with a hall that could seat 6,000 diners and was surrounded by a wall whose perimeter was 4 miles. Outside the court were his food stores, stables, dog kennels, and a menagerie of every sort of exotic animal. At this court, Kublai Khan offered political appointments to the Polos. Marco himself was offered a position as special envoy to Kublai Khan, as well as a governorship of a Chinese province. With his new commission, Marco received a paisa, an inscribed gold tablet from Kublai Khan, which designated him as a guest of the emperor and served as a passport across China and Southeast Asia. This tablet allowed him to move unbothered to areas such as Burma, India, and Tibet. Even if Mongolian political and military presence were not thick in these areas, the fear of military retribution would scare off any would-be robber. His gold tablet also made him welcome at imperial houses across Mongolia, where he was treated as an honored guest. Mongolian political patronage extended throughout much of Asia, and it allowed Polo to become among the first Europeans to investigate these remote regions, and his accounts provide a fascinating glimpse into the cultures and geographies of these heretofore unknown places. His detailed accounts of China describe the use of paper currency, unique manufacturing techniques, extensive postal routes, and forging and heating through the use of coal. He described exotic plants and animals of India, Jakarta, China, and Africa. Now, his accounts also turned fantastic. Marco Polo was well-educated but no naturalist, and he described crocodiles as serpents or dragon and rhinoceri as unicorns. But the travel account of Marco Polo was one of the main texts of European geography well into the age of exploration. Well, over the next couple of years, the Polos traveled throughout Asia and accumulated significant wealth. And it wasn't until 1287 that Polo returned home. He published his memoirs, and they were an instant bestseller all throughout Europe. While we can credit Paulo with being intrepid enough to explore all these different areas in a very dangerous time for foreigners when there was almost no infrastructure for travelers to get around, we have to credit the Mongolians for creating such an expansive trade empire. And they're really ones that united the East and the West in ways that no other state had ever done before. So there you have it. That's Mongolian trade. So we've really covered a lot here in Mongolian Week. We've looked at Mongolian military tactics, everyday life, the life of Genghis Khan, trade, world explorers. Now we're going to look at one final feature that historians have talked about a lot recently, and that is the Mongolian Empire and religious freedom. This is a hot topic because some historians are starting to argue that many of the concepts that we have of religious freedom, toleration of minorities, and even separation of church and state go back to the Mongolian Empire. I'll get into whether that's true or not, but first let's look at the Mongolians themselves and see what sort of influence they had, and in particular, what sort of beliefs they had. The Mongolian people were Tengerians, which is a shamanist belief system. Tengerism means to honor the spirits. Shamanism is a form of animism which holds that everything has a spiritual essence, including rocks, water, and plants. Everything. Humans are living spiritual creatures in a world of other spirits, forces, and gods, with the greatest spirits being Tengri, the eternal blue heaven and Mother Earth. The word Tengri you still see in some Turkic languages, for example in Turkish. One word for God is Tanrı. More devout Muslims will of course use the word Allah, but you still find Tanrı all over the place. These spirits of the sky, land, water, plants, rocks, ancestors, and animals are honored. Tengerism has three main tenets: to take care and honor the spirits, to have personal responsibility, and to keep harmony among all elements of the environment, the community, and oneself. When trouble or illness came, it meant things were out of balance, and a holy man or woman, a shaman, was called to rectify the situation. Genghis the Man was interested in all religions. In fact, many Mongols were shamanists at the same time they practiced other religions. Genghis's sons married Nestorian Christian women, for example. Nestorianism is a branch of Christianity that was declared a heresy in the early ecumenical councils in the 400 and 500s. So many of these Christians went east. They went to Persia, and then they kept going east on the Silk Road, reaching China all the way by the 600s and settling in the lands that were controlled by the Mongols. Genghis and his advisors decided on religious tolerance as a policy, and I'll talk about what tolerance means in a little bit because that's a loaded word, but just bear with me for a second. Rather than antagonize conquered peoples by suppressing their religion, the Mongols exempted religious leaders from taxation and allowed free practice of religion, whether it be Buddhism, Nestorian Christianity, Manichaeism, Taoism, or Islam. The policy ensured an easier governance of conquered territories. Genghis Khan and his descendants employed Buddhists and Muslims in their administration of the empire. Genghis even had close advisors who held to other religions. To the Mongols, then, religious tolerance wasn't only an imperial policy, it was the way they lived. Mongol leaders occasionally invited religious leaders to come and debate each other as a way of exploring and learning about the various religions under their rule. When Ogedai built the Mongols' capital city, Karakorum, he allowed religious leaders to build mosques, churches, lamasseries, and temples for their worshippers. At its height, the Mongol Empire stretched from the Pacific Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea and incorporated many nations and religions. The governance of this huge area would not have been possible without the Mongols' policy of religious tolerance. The great Khans and minor Khans all kept to this policy, even if they themselves converted to one religion or another. Ghazan, Khan of the Ilkhanate division in Iran, for example, converted to Islam in 1295. Kublai Khan practiced Buddhism, but allowed all people he ruled to practice their own religions. Religious tolerance is one of the positive legacies of the Mongol Empire, which was rare then as it is today. Now, I want to point something out. The word tolerance, when we use that word, we're actually using a specific definition of it that comes largely from John Stuart Mill. He defined tolerance as an active embrace of someone who has a different belief system than yours. And you can see this today whenever a president of the United States or maybe a prime minister of another country signs legislation or a bill having to do with religious groups. Usually he'll have leaders of a religious community standing behind him as he's signing the bill. There'll be a pastor, a Catholic priest, an Orthodox priest, an imam, a rabbi, and leaders of whatever religious group might be affected. That is not the definition of tolerance that was employed in the past. Rather, it wasn't an active embrace of the other. It was a passive indifference. It was more of, I will not persecute you or bother you, and I will let you live your own life. If we use this definition of tolerance, you could find this all over the ancient world. You could find this in the Roman Empire. As long as you don't disturb the Roman order, you can practice whatever you want to practice. You could find this in the early Islamic Caliphate, where Jews and Christians could practice their own religion as long as they paid a tax. You can find this in places you wouldn't even expect, like in medieval Spain, when Christians ruled over Muslims. When you get outside of periods like the Inquisition, there were plenty of Christian rulers who happily let Muslims live and let live as long as they paid their taxes and didn't disturb anyone. So this was not so much an ideology of toleration, but just simple effective governance. When you run a large empire, you can't force people to conform to your beliefs. You can't force them to believe what you believe. And yes, this isn't always universal. In the Byzantine Empire, you have persecution of pagans. You have the closing of pagan temples. So this isn't a universal belief, but it's also not uncommon in the ancient world. Now, I want to look at one book in particular that just came out recently by Jack Weatherford called Genghis Khan and the Quest for God. Several years ago, Jack Weatherford wrote a book called Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World that argues in the collapse of the Mongolian Empire. It was because of the Mongols that East and West were brought closer together, and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment were really kicked off by the advanced culture and technology and ideas of China coming to Europe. Now, there's a lot of problems with the book. I won't get into them, but I want to look at the thesis of his book, Genghis Khan and the Quest for God. He argues specifically that it was the Mongols that gave the idea to America in particular of the separation of church and state. And the constitutional division between these two institutions actually goes directly back to the Mongols. They had direct influence on the founding fathers, in particular Thomas Jefferson. This is surprising, but here's his argument. Jefferson read the 18th century History of Genghis Khan the Great by Frenchman François Petit de la Croix. The book emphasized Genghis Khan's religious tolerance and reproduced a text of the Mongolian Law of Religious Freedom, which Petit de la Croix had stressed was the first law of Genghis Khan. As presented in his biography, the Mongol law was a general law offering freedom in very simple words for everyone of every faith. In 1777, 1 year after drafting the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson translated its lofty words into specific legislation when he composed America's first law of religious freedom for his native state of Virginia. And here, Weatherford draws attention to the similarity of wording between the Petit de la Croix, who said that Mongol law forbade anyone to disturb or molest any person on account of religion, and desired that everyone should be left at liberty to profess that which pleased him the best. And the 1777 Virginia law prescribed that no man shall suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but all men shall be free to profess their opinions in matters of a religion. Now, I will say the proof that Jefferson cribbed the lines is more elusive than Weatherford makes out. Weatherford doesn't point to any direct connection, such as an explicit reference by Jefferson to Genghis Khan that he drew inspiration from the book. He states that the elegance and simplicity of the wording of Genghis Khan's religious freedom law attracted Jefferson's attention, but the claim is unreferenced. Even if Jefferson found a simple, concrete example of how to implement religious freedom, the lines are Petit de la Croix, and Jefferson isn't reading the original Mongolian text. He's reading a Frenchman writing at the beginning of the Enlightenment who's translating it into his own language. And don't forget, the original translation of Genghis, the lines that Jefferson supposedly used, end with the line that you can believe whatever you want as long as there be but one God. So Jefferson may have been inspired by a French Enlightenment scholar's interpretation of the Mongols. And even if the Mongols did influence the Founding Father, well, ancient Romans also influenced the Founding Fathers and ancient Greeks as well, and they did not have constitutional democracy in any sort of modern sense of the word. So I don't want to give the Mongols too much credit. And there's much about the Mongols that's fascinating in its own way. Genghis Khan structured society in ways that can seem centuries ahead of their time. But the attempt to link the 13th century steppe practices with 18th century thought is a little bit of a stretch. And I would argue that Genghis Khan separating church and state, if we want to call it that, has to do less with any sort of philosophical principle and more with just simple pragmatic governance. Mongolian official tolerance did not extend to religion being used as justification for opposition to the state. All right, well, that wraps up Mongolian Week. If you would ever like me to cover a civilization like this, I welcome your comments, and you can send them to me by email at info@historyonthenet.com or voicemail at historyunpluggedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history-related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.